thank you all again for sticking around, those who have. I'm going to wrap up our presentations before we move on to Dr. Yoder's discussion, discussing we're calling a micro-dismantling approach to elucidating dissociable effects of knowledge and performance training components of intervention. So this is sort of a new-ish way. It's sort of, we're trying to combine some different ideas for how we go about taking apart interventions to get at the pieces that seem to matter. So I don't need to explain to this group social deficits in ASD, especially as they move through school, are an area of significant concern. Importantly, as kids move through school age and then into high school, we often see in kids who have intact cognitive ability increased awareness, too, of sort of the difference between themselves and others, and often a desire for these kinds of interventions in many ways. Luckily, in the last several years, there's been a real explosion, probably in the last 10 years, studies into these kinds of approaches, and several recent reviews have suggested that social skills interventions can be considered kind of evidence-supported as a broad matter. Some might argue that finding is tenuous, but it's sort of at least a good start. So just like everyone else here today, and I think this is a key theme, I'm going to jump ahead of you, Paul, in terms of one key theme that we're seeing, is we do have to make sure that we really are working in the framework of something that we've found to work before we start to look at treatment mechanisms. I think, you know, there's so many different types of interventions, as Jenna mentioned, out there, and I think it's very easy to sort of want to jump ahead to this step. But importantly, in all of the interventions we're presenting today, there is, you know, multiple replicated converging data sets suggesting, okay, we've got some variance, some change to account for here, and we really need to know that first. In this context, we realize that it's time to examine some common components that are responsible for outcomes. So one way to think about those common components in ASD interventions and in social skills interventions in particular are something that have previously been described by Gresham and others as social knowledge training and social performance training. This is something I've talked a little bit about before. Essentially, you know, social knowledge training is the part of the intervention where you're trying to address issues of social knowledge. That is the idea that kids on the spectrum maybe don't know what to do. So if the issue is social knowledge, if you say that's the mechanism of deficit here, they don't, quote, know what to do, then your intervention should be about giving knowledge. That is telling them the thing they may not otherwise know. And that is indeed a common component. If you open up most of the manuals that are out there, at some point they're giving some didactic information. But importantly, that's distinct and dissociable from social performance training. That is to say, are there factors aside from knowledge that are impacting the performance of perhaps known social goals or targets or behaviors, right? So in ADHD, this is actually a distinction that's been known for almost 20 years now, where people used to think ADHD was a knowledge problem, and then it was discovered in many converging studies that actually factors like impulsivity and inattention were getting in their way, and that kids with ADHD tended to kind of know what to do, but they would get impulsive and things would get in their way. In ASD, we may think of other performance-related factors that are often described in, say, many of the descriptive talks here, right? So these things might be emotion recognition ability. Are you catching the right emotion in the first place to be able to cue you to use that behavior? Or the often discussed social motivation or flexible thinking, right? So these are performance-related factors. And importantly, you wouldn't necessarily address them with a didactic approach. You wouldn't just say, hey, you, be more motivated, do it. Or at least if you tried that, at least as a theoretical proposition, has trouble with the idea of actually affecting the change you want. So crucially, we can actually take these apart from interventions and try to see how they work in distinct ways. And this is part of what's called the dismantling approach. And so the dismantling approach is one of several methodological intervention design approaches that are used in which individuals are randomized to specific elements of a treatment package to identify active ingredients. The idea being that if one of them is doing one set of things and the other one is doing another set of things, you should see distinct patterns of change associated with doing each of these sets of activities. So we've done this actually previously in Starry. We published this is a graph I've shown a lot. And back in 2012, we showed that effects, for instance, in social preference in Starry, which is considered more of a performance training intervention, that is one aspect is the intervention that Jenna was just talking about. And one element of it, for instance, is that, you know, they never actually give kids any didactic training whatsoever. They never say, here's what you do socially. Rather, it's about activities that are designed to target these the sort of enactment of these behaviors and mitigating performance-related factors. And we see, for instance, significantly more social preference, right, friendship-making after just one session. And even over the course of as brief an administration as 4 weeks, once a week, for 90 minutes, which is actually very short for after-school social skills intervention, much shorter than any manualized intervention, we found differences in rates. But the knowledge training group caught up. And I really love showing this graph because I feel like it gets to a key piece, which is a key finding, which is that, you know, we shouldn't use this approach necessarily as a horse race to say, which one's working better, which one's worse, but rather they can be working on different processes over different time scales that might matter differently for different people. And the idea then is that I wanted to kind of zoom in on this even further. So we sort of suggested that a small study using this approach could be used to sort of zoom in on, even within just a few minutes of exposure to these activities, we might actually see some of these differences in the processes that are being changed. So this micro-dismantling approach, then, is an approach in which what we do is we expose kids to just maybe 10 or 15 minutes of each intervention activity and see if we can get change on the target underlying mechanisms. And if we can do this, we might then suggest that repeated exposure to those mechanisms may actually be partially responsible for some of the larger scale findings that we see in these intervention trials. Likewise, you can use this approach if you look at individual individual differences in baseline abilities. We can identify what are called aptitude by treatment effects that Smith and Seacrest defined in 1991, which is basically individual differences based on response. That is to say, if you have certain characteristics that might make you more amenable to one approach or another. So we can actually use this approach to start to get a question of how and for whom. So my goal here today is to demonstrate the use and analysis of this micro-dismantling thing, and to identify differences in effects for social knowledge and performance training on peer engagement. So as you'll see, this is on unstructured peer play. And then also to start to elucidate potential aptitude by treatment effects. So our participants here were 38 well-characterized kids on the spectrum, mean IQ of about 110. And what we did here was we brought them in and we administered baseline measures of social knowledge, which I'll describe in a moment, baseline measures of two performance-related factors, IQ as well as diagnostic status. We then brought them into a room and for 10 minutes and said, all right, we'll be back in a little bit, see you soon. And there were some toys and games, and we saw what they did. So it was a really, truly unstructured peer play session. In dyads, by the way. We then randomly assigned them to just 20 minutes of social knowledge training, so 20 minutes of somebody coming in and telling and giving them essentially a series of rules for behavior pulled directly from existing manuals, and 20 minutes of social performance training pulled from some of the Starry activities that Jenna had alluded to. Then the interventionist said, oh, I gotta go. see you guys soon, and left them, and they had 10 more minutes of unstructured social interaction. And so the training activities, just to give you a sense, were specific instructions from existing manuals on things like how to start a conversation, how to trade information, how to stay on topic, how to express your feelings. And then performance training activities, which I can discuss later if anybody's curious about them, but there are things called like group story, competitive excuses, round of applause. But again, these are all activities in which target the same goals. They're matched in terms of what they're trying to do. But they there's no part of it in which they discreetly say, all right, now I'm going to tell you how to interact with somebody, or that they should do anything. And our outcomes, first, we used the social interaction observation scale of Nurit Bominger, and we looked at that during both of the unstructured peer play sessions and during the activities. And our idea here is that the during activities piece would actually tell us about what kind of engagement is happening while they're actually doing these things, right, while they're actually being taught, which we would expect to be different across groups. And also, again, if there was change pre to post. So we looked at the positive interaction subscale, so how much sort of pro-social play. And this was all coded by blinded coders, and the amount of total interaction. So our social knowledge measure was the Children's Assertive Behavior Scale. So this has been used for about 30 years now, although very little used in the ASD literature. So it's 27 multiple choice items, and there are things like when you meet a new person at a social event, here are some options. What is the right thing to do? Right. So this is sort of truly getting at our question, which is the issue with kids on this, with social interaction, if you're on the spectrum, do you know the right thing to do or not? This has been shown in other samples to correlate with parent, peer, and teacher report of social competency, and even discriminates between children with and without a history of social skills training. And interestingly, I just want to note, this isn't the topic of this study, but I will note that our sample norm of kids on the spectrum had more variance, but the mean was almost identical to a typically developing norm. So we actually didn't find evidence that having an autism diagnosis, well-characterized ASD diagnosis, was related to having problems with this. We can still analyze it, but I do think it's a neat point. And then to measure our social performance-related factors, we first looked at what's called social information processing speed, which is the efficiency with which kids were able to sort of catch social information when it came their way. And we measured this by looking at the N170 latency during a facial emotion recognition task. I won't get into ERP methodology today, but basically we looked at, did it not appear? Lovely, thank you. On this slide is the waveform of the N170, which is thought to propagate from the fusiform gyrus and essentially indicates again the sort of catching a face as a face as opposed to a non-face object. We also looked at social creativity, which is sort of an index of ability to generate novel responses to social interaction, sort of the opposite of social knowledge. So we would give them questions like, there are some kids you want to play with, how would you get them to play with you? Try to think of ideas that other kids might not have. We then recorded it, and blinded raters scored these on a 7-point Likert scale on which they were previously trained. There's very good reliability here. Interestingly, in typically developing kids, this has been shown to correlate highly in large samples of middle school kids, for instance, with social competency, friendship making in schools, and parenting, sort of positive parenting styles. So in our current sample, we had a mean of about 2.6 standard deviation of 0.96, which is quite a bit lower than we typically see here. So, again, our sort of three sets of hypotheses were whether or not the condition you were in would lead to change in your social behavior, whether or not baseline factors might predict that change irrespective of your condition. So it may just be that there are some kids who are just going to kind of do great no matter what you do. So put them in a group. They'll be fine, and they'll learn from that. And then, of course, whether or not that predicts individual differences in response by condition. So we used an overall ANCOVA of change model, so sort of similar principle to what Jenna was talking about, control for baseline, predict endpoint, control for other things you care about. But we did, we controlled for IQ and ADOS score. And we used what are called generalized estimating equations. I'm not going to get too much into this today unless anybody asks, but essentially, generalized estimating equations are a lot like HLM by allowing for intercorrelation within group. But unlike HLM, it doesn't actually estimate the amount of that ICC component that Jenna was talking about, but it just sort of allows there to be this unstructured amount of extra variance. It sort of says, I don't really want to model it, but I want to know that it's there and I want to make sure I've taken care of it. So again, it's used sort of when there's nesting, but only if you don't really care about that nesting. Which again, in Jenna's case, we did care about the nesting. Here we really want to know about the change at the individual level. There's a statistic called QIC that you use to adjudicate between different models, but based on the link function that's used as well as the type of correlation matrix you use. We use a full maximum likelihood estimation approach with, in this case, dyad, right? So these kids are in peer dyads as the repeated subject factor. So what do we find? So we found that we found a relative increase in the total interaction and positive interaction between pretest and during the activities. So in performance training relative to knowledge. So this isn't to say that kids in performance training condition were necessarily, so this is a residualized change score on the y-axis. It's a little confusing. So it's not to say, for instance, I can't even see this laser, that they did more, but that rather this slope, this is sort of comparing slopes, that if you're in knowledge training, the amount of interaction you're doing relative to when you're in peer play is less. When you're in your performance training, it's more, which is sort of the principle of performance training, right? We want them to be doing a thing during it rather than listening. So this was sort of a nice proof of principle. Good. We also looked at, for the second hypothesis, we actually found that having a faster N170 predicted increased total interaction after, as well as positive interaction after, so between those two unstructured time points. That is to say, and this is, I think, really crucial, that this N170 biomarker that's been identified over and over again is related to face processing and ASD and slower in ASD. There's individual difference in this within the spectrum, and those who did better at this actually just sort of like it was almost like a snowball effect. It didn't matter what condition you put them in, they just sort of were picking up interaction and playing more with their peer, which really suggested this to be quite a powerful and robust little biomarker. We also, though, however, found that there were greater increases specifically in the positive and total interaction after social knowledge, performance training relative to social knowledge training. So it's not just that the N170 was helpful, faster N170 was helpful overall, but it was actually especially helpful. So kids who had this sort of faster ability to catch social information, it was especially helpful for them when they were in this performance training condition, when they sort of, in some sense, had more opportunity to interact. The colors there are flipped. I apologize. What we found, however, conversely, is that those who had more social knowledge at baseline showed greater increases in positive interaction during social knowledge training. That's to say that essentially if you were already somebody who answered correctly to a lot of those questionnaire questions I said at the beginning, and then you were in a group in which, or a little mini session in which somebody gave you more of those rules, you kind of took it and you said, oh great, I like these rules, and you started to use them. So again, we found greater increases in positive peer interaction during social performance training. Suggesting that it really is this opportunity for engagement, which is sort of part of the theory of this performance training approach. We found that social performance-related factors, interestingly, no effect for social creativity in these models. But we did find this N170 to be really quite profound, especially given that it's, you know, we're talking about individual differences on the order of milliseconds. I'd be happy to discuss why we might think that might be. But the thought is that these kids are picking up on the momentum of positive interaction that even generalized post-session, after 20 minutes, and it may be uniquely amenable to potentiating response to performance training type interventions. While social knowledge perhaps acts as something like a learning style. So maybe it's, rather than saying this is an essential component of all intervention, social skills interventions, maybe sort of teaching specific rules is a great approach for kids who like rules. And that's actually quite a useful principle. So I'm out of time, but let me just say some of the methodological value here. We sort of demonstrated this micro-dismantling approach, showed a little bit about how to use generalized estimating equations, and talked about baseline by condition interactions. So I just want to thank those who funded this work, my team at Stony Brook, my collaborators at UVA and elsewhere, and of course all the participating families, and I think we have about a few minutes for questions. Yes?
How did you account for the fact that it was age 10 to 17 year olds?
Mm-hmm.
How did you account for the fact that neurotypical 10 to 17 year olds, if they're in a room with people they don't know, they're really not going to talk to them?
Mm-hmm.
And then once you get them into a context where they start interacting, then that kind of gives them permission to continue to interact? So just trying to think about, I'm just wondering how you accounted for that.
So, meaning, one situation might be a little bit, so sort of sitting, being dropped in a room alone with somebody is sort of a weird experience for any kid, that point?
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Especially at that age.
Yes, it is. And certainly, you know, if I showed you any of those videos, you know, there's some awkwardness there at the beginning, and that would be true if we had a typical comparison group. I suppose, you know, one thing is that we wanted to create a situation that had a sort of unusual amount of social demands so that we could actually get some variance regardless. So you're right. It was weird and atypical, and these kids thought, well, what am I doing here with this other guy? But in some sense, that was more useful to us in terms of trying to characterize the behavior during that sort of a pretest session. Then if we said, okay, we want you to go play with this other person, or this is somebody you might like. So we kind of, rather than gaming it for interaction, we actually kind of wanted to game it towards neutrality.
Did you make sure you took away their screens during that time?
Took away their screens?
Yeah, like their iPhones and stuff?
Yes. Yes, this was very important this is one of the great values of pilot testing, your assessments. Because when we were pilot testing this immediately, like the very, very first pilot session, we were like, yeah, all right, fair enough. They need to just kind of, they can't have any other distraction other than the things in the room. But really good point. And of course, the other key piece is we wanted to make sure there was going to be an equivalent baseline condition for both groups, and sort of equivalently challenging, so that we can make a meaningful comparison. Other questions? Right. So just to go back to, it's a good question. This, in terms of the actual procedural steps, where'd they go? Right. We would bring two kids in at once. We'd schedule visits. This is about a two-hour visit for two kids at once. Right. So they would go in pairs with through this sequence. So either you went with your pair, with the dyad member through social knowledge training or social performance training, you would do it with them. So the pre and post interaction were all three of those interactions were with the same peer, including the condition to which they were assigned. So we didn't account for sort of differences in their training experience, at least not yet. Again, in terms of sort of wanting to make sure that what we're talking about is what's the effect on your interaction with a peer when you've had this same common experience with them. Time for maybe one more question before. Yes?
Is there the
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you'd think so. This is a really good question. So to be clear again, it was the same kid, right? So kid A, you know, Johnny and Jimmy did unstructured social interaction together, then Johnny and Jimmy did social knowledge training, and then Johnny and Jimmy did social interaction post-test. Susie and Sally did social interaction training, then Susie and Sally did social performance training, then Susie and Sally did social interaction training together, right? Just the two of them in the room. So, right, practice effects is a really important question, but of course this gets to one of the core presumptions that we maybe, or assumptions we have about ASE, which is that we actually often will, when we're designing these interventions especially, we often design our interventions presuming that a practice effect like that either is implausible or very difficult to elicit, right? And in fact, one of the presumptions of social deficit is that having the experience of interacting with a peer isn't going to potentiate more interaction with that peer. And that's, you know, why we have these interventions to begin with. And it's why we actually, why breaking out social knowledge as a component to target is so crucial. Because we for 25 years have suggested that instead of repeated successful experiences leading to more interaction, the kind of social snowball that we might all have, you know, tonight over dinner, say, with various people you meet from the conference, that's something that having ASD gets in the way of, right? Rather than presuming that, these interventions have long presumed that can't happen or shouldn't happen or will very unlikely. It's very unlikely to happen. And instead, we need to say, you got to do this. If you don't do this, then you're not going to interact, and that should actually be the mechanism, right? That should be an active ingredient. So that's really, we're creating a strict test of that presumption. And what was really quite striking is our finding that doesn't actually seem to be the case, that these kids, that in fact the practice effects, which seem so obvious to you, are present despite the fact that we've presumed for a long time that they shouldn't be. Ah, to a different set of kids. Absolutely, and that's a good example of a future direction here. What we're really trying to do is kind of hone in on the kind of core ingredients of these effects, but you're absolutely right. The next key question is, do they take this with them, right? Similar to, you know, the issue with, you know, another similarity between my study and Jenna's is, of course, we're still looking at the kids they just did this thing with, and maybe it's context dependent, and maybe they go back into the schools and see no changes. So that's actually one of, we have a grant under review right now where we're planning to go into the schools and pre and post test them on peer interaction in their schools, based on these kinds of comparisons. I think I want to make sure we give Dr. Yoder his time, but if you wouldn't mind holding your question for the general discussion, that'd be great.